Residents voted to pass a fracking ban last November, and she's lead singer with the Frackettes. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
You were tuned in to KBOO Portland, coming up on 5 o'clock. Up next, the KBOO Evening News.
If you're interested in creating queer programming, come to KBOO on Wednesday, June 3rd at 7 p.m. for an information session. You'll learn about how to start a show, the trainings involved, and the obligations for being a KBOO volunteer, and more. Again, that's an information session for queer programming on Wednesday, June 3rd at 7 p.m. at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm/outloud.
Join us for the KBOO Community Radio Monthly Film Night at the Clinton Street Theater. This month, we'll be showing the film Death Metal Angola on Thursday, June 11th at 7 p.m. This documentary traces how death metal has taken root in the Southwest African country of Angola, with its history of war and civil unrest. Creating something new is an act of defiance in the face of destruction. Again, that's Death Metal Angola at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, residents of the Eastmoreland neighborhood try to save three ancient sequoias from being cut down.
Portland City Council hears testimony about a proposal to create a new public utility board.
And a secret meeting in South Africa is exposed by food activists who say it's an attempt by multinationals to take over the African food system.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 3rd, 2015. I'm Tarina Aguilar.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. The Portland City Council this morning heard testimony on a proposal for a new public utility board. Under the proposed ordinance, nine new board members will be appointed by the mayor this summer. If approved, the new board will replace the existing Public Utility Review Board and the individual utility budget advisory committees and will report directly to the council. Floyd Jones of Friends of the Reservoirs was one of those who testified at this morning's meeting.
With Friends of the Reservoirs, an all-volunteer grassroots group. And of all the people testifying today and who actually participated in this Blue Ribbon Committee, I represent the only organization that's been consistently providing oversight to the independent oversight to the Water Bureau for the last 12 years. We're facing another 7% rate increase, which for middle-class ratepayers is a struggle on top of the high rate increases we've already seen. And, you know, I'm sorry to say that I agree with comments that Commissioner Salzman made early on. I really see no provisions in this that's going to make this commission any different than what exists today. There's nothing in there that requires an annual independent line item budget oversight of the budget. You know, for all these years, the Water Bureau has refused to entertain any suggestions that make the budget smaller, only that expand the budget. You can throw out a million suggestions for expanding and growing. And our Water Bureau's grown 40% since I first started seriously monitoring the budget in 2004. There are now close to 70 employees that make close to $100,000, while water demand has declined since 1988. So why would we expand? I also wanted to comment relating to this. You know, the discovery that you've given Cub praise for, well, of course, council has known about that. It's in our lawsuit. It's been in the lawsuit since 2011, making ratepayers pay for system development costs for developers. So, you know, that's hardly a Cub discovery, and it should have been addressed last year. You know, Dwight Holden did a great job for the mission that he was given, but you really need to strengthen this if it's going to be any different, and it needs to most certainly be made public well in advance when these meetings occur, and, you know, more than just 2 minutes of comment at the end. People who have been participating and interested in our water system and our sewer and stormwater system need to be able to participate. And the focus really shouldn't be, I've heard these words being used and during the budget discussions, that the focus needs to be on education, which I view as, you know, really code for propagandizing the need for further increases. And that really doesn't need to be the focus. It really needs to be true oversight, true independent oversight.
The review panel, which initially proposed the idea of the Public Utility Board, also recommended that the city should seek an audit or independent review to evaluate the effectiveness of the board, but that was not included in the ordinance introduced today by Nick Fish.
Washington County will reopen a closed health clinic after Planned Parenthood retracted its bid to provide family planning services in that county. The county plans to reopen a recently closed clinic 2 days a week until a prospective provider is in place. The county voted in April to close the two county-run clinics and replace them with a network of private, nonprofit clinics, of which Planned Parenthood was one. State health officials say they are watching the situation closely.
Portland Community College is adding 22 single-occupancy, gender-neutral restrooms to its Sylvania campus this year. The college is also making changes to its classroom roster, noting students by their preferred names rather than their legal names. Students have been asked for this change, has been asking for this change since 2011. PCC has the highest concentration of transgender and gender nonconforming students of any Oregon community college. Students have reported discomfort and bullying due to the lack of gender-neutral bathrooms. The students who organized the campaign say the next step will be to get a trans-friendly locker room as well so they can attend physical education classes.
In a new article published at Civil Eats, two prominent scientists have pointed out several factual errors made by Bill Nye, the science guy, about genetically modified crops. The prominent science educator recently changed his position on GMO crops after a visit to Monsanto's agricultural facilities. Bill Nye had voiced opposition to genetically modified crops beginning in 2005. But Monsanto scientists apparently persuaded him to change his position. According to Dr. Doug Gurian-Sherman of the Center for Food Safety, Nye's recent statement in support of GMOs includes a number of factual errors. He spoke with KBOO's Jenka Soderberg about how Bill Nye got it wrong.
Over 20 years ago, and they decided at that time that that glyphosate, the herbicide, was not a carcinogen. This is, again, an independent international body revising that data. And, of course, Monsanto, which makes the herbicide and sells the engineered seeds, was very upset and has tried to, smear this agency with 17 international scientists, including scientists from the U.S. So Bill Nye was just flat out mistaken about this. And on top of that, he then went on to try to blame the huge decrease in monarch butterflies, the iconic butterfly species in the U.S. Midwest that has the longest migration of any insect in the world from the upper Midwest down to Mexico where it overwinters. And he correctly identified that these populations had decreased by over 90% in the last 20 years, but then seemed to blame it on industrial agriculture generally. And I agree with him that industrial agriculture has a lot of causes a lot of big problems and needs to change. But in this particular case, industrial agriculture existed before these crops, and monarchs were doing fine. But it's specifically the herbicide glyphosate, which is used on these crops is very toxic to the only plant that monarch caterpillars can use for food during the migration, and that's milkweed. And the herbicide is highly toxic to milkweed. Lots of herbicides were used before these crops and were not as toxic to milkweed. So small amounts of milkweed were found in corn fields throughout the Midwest and provided enough food on the migration for monarchs without, and this is important to understand, without causing, by and large, any real damage to the crops because the numbers were fairly small. But in aggregate, spread over the whole Midwest, there was enough of this milkweed to support monarchs. So it's not just industrial agriculture. It's genetically engineered crops and the herbicides that they were designed to use that has specifically wiped out the food for monarchs in the Midwest. So these are two huge errors. And in doing so, Nye really has let the biotech industry off the hook in terms of the harm it's doing to the environment.
After his visit to the Monsanto headquarters, he began to promote Monsanto's plan to put in some milkweed habitat. What's the problem with that plan?
Well, increasing habitat, this is outside of, crop fields, is a good idea, and it should be encouraged. There's not enough of that habitat, and not only for monarchs, but other beneficial insects, pollinators, and others need more of that habitat. The problem is that in the Corn Belt, there is very, very little of that kind of habitat left, and most of the land is private land. So, increasing the amount of that habitat to a meaningful level and planting milkweed on it to help the monarchs, there is, serious questions about whether that's going to be enough. It may help a little bit, but it's doubtful that there's enough of that land to help enough. But, of course, this is exactly the kind of plan Monsanto wants to promote because it does nothing to change what really needs to change, which is the way we do farming in the Midwest. And we know from, again, lots of scientific data and experiments that we can do farming much more sustainably and ecologically, organic farming, but other types of what we call agroecology that that can cut down on pesticide use, including herbicides, by over 90%. And changing the way we do agriculture seems to be exactly what Bill Nye has said that he wants. He has, called out industrial monoculture as the problem, and yet again, the very type of crops that he is now apparently supporting are exacerbating industrial monoculture and exacerbating the very kind of agriculture and encouraging the very kind of agriculture that he says he would like to see changed.
I've been speaking with Dr. Doug Gurian-Sherman. He is the Center for Food Safety's Director of Sustainable Agriculture and Senior Scientist. He also previously worked at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. You can find his piece, What Bill Nye Got Wrong in His About Face on GMOs, co-written with Margaret Mellon, on civileats.com. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Politicians and executives from some of the world's biggest agribusiness companies met today in Cape Town, South Africa, for a secretive meeting, which critics say is an attempt by corporations to steal food resources from Africa. There's been no publicity around the meeting of a committee of the G8, known as the New Alliance for Food Security and Nutrition, or New Alliance for short. No details or mentions of the meeting are publicly available, but its existence was leaked by one of its attendees. In response to the meeting, a coalition of civil society groups released a statement calling on the G8 and African governments to stop supporting the New Alliance. According to the statement, the New Alliance policies facilitate land grabs and natural resource theft by international agribusiness companies. The group Global Justice Now released a video today called "Whoever Controls Seeds Controls the Food System." Here is a clip.
My mother gave me some seeds to plant, and I'm also giving those seeds to my children to plant. So that is ongoing. Every time we transfer to our children, and that is how all the women are doing. We don't buy, we produce it ourselves. After harvesting, the women are able to store the seeds, vegetable seeds, like pumpkin leaves, okra. They're able to dry it, tie it, and preserve it using ash. So when the year comes, they go out to bring these seeds to sow again. Seed is where you grow your food from. So if you save the seed, then you grow food the following year. It's very economical, because you don't have to go and buy seed. That is what we farmers have always done.
When we have these multinational seed companies influencing what we plant here, and our government endorsing it to such an extent that nobody can plant any other thing, the smallholder farmers will be played out of the game.
We, the smallholder farmers, want to have good lives. We want to be healthy. We have our seed systems that we like and are proud of. So we do not want multinational companies to come in and take over our seed systems.
Launched by the G8 in 2012, the new alliance provides aid money from the G8 countries and helps big business invest in different countries in the African agricultural sector. In return, African countries are required to change their land, seed, and trade rules to favor big agribusiness companies. In the last year, controversies associated with the new alliance have included a dispute over a bill in Ghana dubbed the Monsanto Law, which would bolster the power of multinational seed companies while restricting the rights of small farmers to keep and swap seeds. In another new alliance initiative, farmers in Nigeria's Taraba State are being forced off their lands that they have farmed for generations to make way for the U.S. company Dominion Farms to establish a 30,000-hectare rice plantation. And in Tanzania, about 1,300 people are at risk of losing their land or homes to make way for a sugarcane plantation, which is also a new alliance project. 2 years ago, over 100 African civil society organizations branded the new alliance a, quote, new wave of colonialism.
Despite the billions of dollars spent on airport security over the last 14 years, Department of Homeland Security agents carrying fake bombs and weapons were still able to get through TSA checkpoints in 67 of 70 cases. As a result of the high rate of failure, Secretary of Homeland Security Jay Johnson has reassigned the current head of the TSA and ordered a full review of security procedures.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Wednesday, June 3rd, 2015. Israeli Navy attacked fishing boats near Gaza shoreline and in the West Bank, troops kidnapped 13 civilians. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli Navy ships attacked on Wednesday several Palestinian fishing boats in Gaza territorial waters and kidnapped five fishers. Meanwhile, Israeli army vehicles carried out a limited invasion into southern Gaza, opened fire moderately wounding one Palestinian. Eyewitnesses said that the Navy ships fired rounds of live ammunition on Palestinian fishing boats and surrounded them before kidnapping five fishers. Also on Wednesday, soldiers opened fire at a number of Palestinian farmers in their own lands east of Khuza'a town, east of the southern Gaza Strip city of Khan Yunis. Medical sources said that one Palestinian suffered a moderate injury and was moved to a nearby hospital. In addition, several armored military vehicles carried out a limited invasion into Rafah. In the West Bank, Israeli soldiers invaded Wednesday dozens of Palestinian communities in different parts of the occupied West Bank, searched and ransacked homes, and kidnapped at least 13 Palestinians. Several Israeli military vehicles invaded Beit Umar town north of Hebron and kidnapped two Palestinians after violently searching their homes. Clashes took place between the invading soldiers and dozens of local youth, while many Palestinians suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation. Similar invasions targeted Yatta town south of Hebron in addition to Tarkumia and Beit Awa towns southwest of the city, leading to abduction of two Palestinians. In addition, the army invaded various communities in the northern West Bank district of Nablus, searched and ransacked homes and kidnapped three Palestinians. Soldiers also invaded Beit Rima village north of the northern West Bank city of Tulkarem and kidnapped one man. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, June 3rd, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Banoura.
The KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for news from the BOO, followed by Treasures from the Archives on at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is partly to mostly cloudy with a high of 75, moving to mostly clear and 53 at night, winds at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Perfect. Today in history, 1889, the first long-distance electric power transmission line in the United States is completed, running 14 miles between a generator at Willamette Falls and downtown Portland. The quote of the day is from Oscar Wilde, "Always forgive your enemies, nothing else annoys them as much."
It is 5:21, time now for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The price of liberty is said to be eternal vigilance. But just being watchful rarely does anything to stop the theft of our rights. Instead, the real price of liberty is open defiance, the courage to stand against the oppressors. And the price of that can be prison. Doug Hughes has dared to defy the corrupt plutocratic order that the moneyed elites, both political parties, and the Supreme Court have imposed over us. Dismayed and disgusted that we the people are blocked by big money from having our voices heard and responded to, this Florida letter carrier chose to get heard with one dramatic act of civil disobedience. In April, Hughes flew his homemade gyrocopter across Washington and onto the lawn of the U.S. Capitol to protest the usurpation of our most basic freedom, the right to be self-governing. This was no stunt, no spur-of-the-moment outburst, but a thoughtful, well-planned, nonviolent stand against the tyranny of money. Undertaken in the spirit of Henry David Thoreau and Martin Luther King Jr., this mailman on a mission was fully aware of and prepared to pay the price of civic defiance. Sure enough, on May 20th, a federal grand jury indicted this messenger of democracy on a mess of charges that could add up to more than 9 years in prison. Far from backing away, however, he's now calling out you and me. "We spend billions protecting the United States from terrorists," Hughes recently wrote. "It's time for Americans to spend time protecting democracy from plutocrats." This is Jim Hightower saying, one time when Thoreau was in jail for his defiance of authority, his friend Ralph Waldo Emerson happened by and asked, "Henry, why are you here?" Thoreau retorted, "Why are you not here?" To be there with Doug in the fight to save democracy from plutocracy, go to democracyisforpeople.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The American Postal Workers Union says its labor contract talks with the U.S. Postal Service are at an impasse. The talks broke off May 27th without an agreement on a new contract. The union says the severe cuts in pay and benefits demanded by the Postal Service management scuttled any prospect of reaching a deal. Among the cuts are the elimination of cost of living adjustments, increases in worker costs for health care coverage, and creation of a new and permanent lower pay scale for future postal workers with reduced benefits. The APWU says it will participate in mediation and then go on to arbitration if there's still no agreement. To show they are in solidarity with their leadership, postal workers are being encouraged to wear union clothing at work every Thursday, starting this week, until there's a new agreement. The Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, wants the aviation industry to do more to combat human trafficking aboard aircraft. The union says many of the estimated 4 million victims of human trafficking worldwide each year are transported on planes staffed by flight attendant union members. AFA International President Sarah Nelson says infrastructure and training is already in place to try to identify human trafficking in a system called Blue Lightning. It's a program by the Transportation Department launched in 2013. It teaches airline personnel about how to recognize human trafficking, and Nelson is calling for all airlines to participate in that program. The Chicago Teachers Union says it isn't surprised by the resignation of Chicago Public Schools Chief Barbara Bird Bennett. She had been on administrative leave due to a federal investigation into a no-bid $20.5 million contract with Supes Academy in Wilmette. Bird Bennett once worked for Supes. The contract was for training for school administrators. The teachers union says Bird Bennett leaves Chicago under a cloud of suspicion and chaos after closing 50 public schools in a single year. Workers Independent News is trying to improve our coverage of the low-wage worker movement. For more information on that, please go to Indiegogo.com and search for Raise the Wage. It'll help keep voices like these on the radio news airwaves.
If you never fought for anything in your life, fight for this living wage so that the kids of our future can have a way that we didn't have.
For more information on increasing our coverage of the low-wage worker movement, go to Indiegogo.com and search for Raise the Wage. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the National Association of Letter Carriers and from the United Auto Workers.
Workers Independent News is brought to you by Ulico. For more than 85 years, Ulico has been protecting union workers with quality, affordable insurance while responsibly investing union funds to create jobs and achieve respectable returns. More information is available online at ulico.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
WikiLeaks on Wednesday released another 17 separate documents related to the Trade in Services Agreement. This is one of a few times WikiLeaks has revealed documents related to U.S. trade agreements, including the controversial Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement, also known as the TPP. The leaked documents include issues of transportation, e-commerce, and the regulation of financial services, according to The Guardian. Evan Greer from Fight for the Future says the documents reveal that the Trade and Services Agreement contains provisions that could threaten internet freedom, privacy, and even global net neutrality. The trade agreements, including the TPP, currently making their way through Congress, are notoriously secretive, but WikiLeaks is continuing its efforts to bring to light the agreements and their implications on the public interest.
An initiative called the Global Apollo Program claims that it will be possible to meet the world's electricity demand with only wind and/or solar power within the next 10 years. The report continues to say that this energy would be cheaper than coal power. Their calculations state that this goal could be reached with an investment of $230 billion. According to EcoWatch, this is the same amount, in today's terms, required to put a man on the moon. While it would be incredibly expensive, the program argues that this transition must happen to avoid, quote, irreparable damage to the planet.
Local experts got together this morning in a telebriefing to discuss the Northwest's role in the expansion of fossil fuel infrastructure. States like Oregon, Washington, and Montana are ideal targets for the fossil fuel industry due to their proximity to the supply of fuel and to ports for exporting that fuel. Experts warn of the effects of increased involvement in the fossil fuel industry, including traffic congestion, safety concerns, and the impact on the environment. Eric Duplass, the policy director at Sightline Institute, and Jeannie Alderson, a fourth-generation rancher from Montana, comment on the industry's proposals on the export and transportation of fossil fuels and what it means for the Northwest.
In the last few years, we've seen a real drastically increased level of concern, not just from sort of quote-unquote environmentalists or green constituencies, but from constituencies of all sorts across the region who have begun to wonder whether or not the economy and the way of life we've developed in the Northwest is in fact scheduled to change drastically, and we're going to become a major energy export region similar to the Houston, Galveston, Louisiana area. And that's a real possible future for this region. Suffice it to say that what's been planned for train delivery to the coast of Oregon and Washington exceeds the volume of oil that would flow through the Keystone XL pipeline, and that actually exceeds it dramatically. We couldn't begin to refine all of this oil, even if we got rid of every drop that comes by pipeline, even if we got rid of every drop that comes by tanker vessel. We could not come close to refining all of the oil that is scheduled for delivery by train to this region. That's a calculation of traffic delays owing to coal and oil trains. So this is what happens when a train passes over an at-grade crossing. And I've done these calculations here for the Spokane and sort of North Idaho area, where all of the coal and oil trains will pass, both arriving and returning. So that's what you're seeing here. I often get in debates with industry about this, and it's extremely frustrating to me. I don't have a lot of hair left to tear out, but I sometimes want to tear out what remains, because this is actually simple math. We know how long the trains are. We know how fast they can travel. And as a consequence of those two features, and we know how many there will be, we know that these trains will shut down streets for 2 to 4 hours every single day, 365 days a year on average. That's a huge economic cost, not to mention a huge annoyance for people. I think if you add up the economic cost of those street closures from mine to port, you end up with a tremendous impact on local communities, an impact, by the way, which the industry is will do nothing to pay for.
The thing about railroads is that they have, just because they're on the list of things, they have the awesome power of eminent domain, the federal power to condemn land. So they can take land, and it seems just crazy to us that this privately owned railroad, which would haul coal from a privately owned mine to privately owned ports, gets this awesome federal power. I think the impacts to us with coal mining, we live in, it's almost a desert here. It's semi-arid. Grass and water are our life, and the other thing that we depend on are our neighbors and our community. And I think all of those are threatened by this expansion of coal development. It is so important, as we talk about burning coal, that the impacts on climate change are just huge and immense. But I think in all of that discussion, we sometimes forget to talk about water. And for us, in our part of the world, coal is our aquifer. And the coal in our area is important where it is, which is in the ground. And anything that you do with coal damages, wastes, pollutes water.
The Columbia River is actually a good example of a place where lots of oil is moved by ATB, by barge. And according to the calculations that I've done, you see basically a doubling of major vessel traffic just from new fossil projects that have been proposed for the lower Columbia. They see the Northwest as their Hail Mary pass. They see this as their last-ditch effort to find some market. And so they're planning to put all their eggs or many of their eggs anyway, in the Northwest export basket. But it's not a healthy industry. The story for oil and gas and the other projects is more complicated. But the one for coal is pretty clear.
One of the things that's incredibly powerful is the broad and diverse set of voices that are coming out and self-organizing and joining together to oppose all of this. And that, I think, is also something that we've seen that you can also argue is unprecedented.
That was Kimberly Larson speaking.
Ms. McCullough.
That was Kimberly Larson speaking in a telebriefing about the Northwest's role in the expanding fossil fuels industries.
KBOO's Jimmy Tardy spoke with Mr. Robert McCullough, president of both the Eastmoreland Neighborhood Association and Southeast Uplift, about the pending demolition of a home in Southeast Portland. Notice was given for the demolition this week, and apparently includes the destruction of three sequoias, all of which are well over 100 years old.
Mr. McCullough, we understand that there are three sequoias that are over 100 years old on a piece of property that's being developed. We also understand that you've attempted to raise the issue with the city regarding these sequoias and the process that is being undertaken to approve their removal. I'm curious about how you've raised that issue, how that's gone, and what the response has been.
Thank you very much. Robert McCullough here. I'm president of Eastmoreland. I'm also president of Southeast Uplift, which is the coalition of 20 neighborhoods in Southeast Portland. And these are common issues across the city. Everett Custom Homes has proposed knocking down an older house in the area and building two McMansions. There's nothing wrong with that per se. Unfortunately, there are a number of trees, including three trees, sequoias, some people call them redwoods, 150 feet tall, and I'm told 150 years old, so they're even older than we are. We learned about this yesterday when the neighbors around the house were notified that demolition was about to occur. Now, that's a little strange because we changed the rules about a month ago and require now notice and a variety of steps before a demolition. But it turns out the developer found a loophole. He used the old rules, then used an interpretation of the old rules, and that allowed him to skip all of the delay and notification steps. Obviously, that makes neighbors very angry, and I have had easily 100 calls and emails from angry neighbors on this in the last day. Now, interestingly enough, we don't need to cut down the big trees. The trees are being cut down because the developer wants to build cookie counter homes, and each home looks exactly the same. Very little design, frankly, often very little beauty. I approached the city's leading architect, one of the founders of the famous Bura firm, the fellow who designed the Performing Arts Center, and that's Robert Oringdolf, and I asked him, if we could bring you into this, would you design a home for the developer? And the developer would never normally be able to afford a leading architect like this. Would you design a home for the developer that keeps the trees? And meets the highest possible levels of architecture. And he said, yes, I would. So we have a win-win-win for everyone. A win for the developer. He has a far more valuable home. A win for Portland. We keep these irreplaceable trees. And a win for the commissioner. Now, that's good news. Unfortunately, I can't quite get in touch with the commissioner. So I'm a little out of luck at the moment.
And you're talking about Commissioner Fritz?
Yes, Commissioner Amanda Fritz. I've sent her emails, I've done a number of calls. It's not as if I don't know her, but I need her involved because I need someone to bring the developer, the community, and the architect into one place. And if I can, I would ask everyone to have a little fun with this. It's a serious issue, but sometimes there's a little room for fun. If you're feeling like it, would you call Amanda at 503-823-3008? And ask her to give me a call. I really do need to bring this proposal to her. And if you want to email her, it's amanda@portlandoregon.gov. And we are trying to solve the problem, and we need her help.
Can you tell me about the changes in the rules that you mentioned and how they're different now?
Yes. Traditionally, in Portland, there was a notice and delay rule. And that got eroded over the last few years by some very excellent lobbying. And most of all, there was a little-known provision called the K-1 exemption. And the K-1 exemption said, if you're building one house and demolishing one house, you don't need to tell anyone there are no delays, you just go do it. That K-1 exemption was very controversial. People would wake up in the morning and find a bulldozer knocking down the house next to them. One of our neighbors found their house full of asbestos-laced dust because she had no warning and she'd left the windows open on a warm summer day. We had other demolitions without warning across from schoolyards, possible health implications for children. The K-1 exemption was eliminated last month after a lot of lobbying by Eastmoreland, Southeast Uplift, other community organizations. However, this builder used the K-1 exemption because he filed his papers before the new rules came into effect. But there was also a little bit of a nudge-nudge, wink-wink, to quote Monty Python, because the K-1 exemption only applies to one home, not two. The builder intends to build two. So even under the old rules, he should have been subject to delay and notice provisions. And if he had been, we would have learned about this quite a bit before yesterday. And we would have saved a lot of controversy and a lot of anger that's developing. So, as always in Portland, there's this question of what are the rules, are they being followed, and whose job it is to enforce them. All too often, turns out it's the job of the neighbors to enforce them because nobody else is keeping an eye on the ball.
Portland has a tradition of having strong neighborhood associations, and I understand that the neighborhood associations have sort of a primary focus concerning land use. If the neighborhood association is unable to even connect with their elected leadership regarding land use, where does this leave the neighborhood associations, and what sort of tarnish does it make on the reputation of Portland and its investment in its neighborhoods?
Well, I agree entirely. The neighborhood association structure, 95 neighborhood associations, 7 coalitions, and the Office of Neighborhood Involvement, reporting to the mayor. Over the last few years, there's been a little impatience with this. As you probably remember, we had a knockdown, drag-out fight with Commissioner Novick over the street fee, very little public involvement. Finally, I had to sue him to get the numbers from him. That's not a working process. Amanda Fritz has done a better job than this, and there are some improvements. But unfortunately, we need to be able to contact her immediately at times, as in this case where we had no notice. If we're going to save those trees, we have to save them right now. Because the next interview with you will be after the 150-foot trees are in fact history. And I don't want that to happen if I can possibly help avoid it.
What's the timeline for removal of the trees as you understand it?
The neighbors were told demolition would start today.
And that is specifically regarding demolition of the home, but I understand that you're not entirely certain what that means regarding the trees?
Right. We've tried to contact the builder, and we've not gotten a response from him yet.
Can you give us the exact address of where these trees are so that people might be able to go and view them for themselves?
Yes, 3640 Southeast Martins. Drive on over to Reed College on Woodstock, turn on 36, going south, and then take the first turn to the east, and then you're on Martins, and you can't miss the trees. Believe me, they are towering and beautiful, and I would recommend visiting them now because you may not be able to see them later.
And once again, you're asking people to contact Amanda Fritz. That's at amanda@portlandoregon.gov, and also to call her office at 503-823-3008 and request that she meet with you, Mr. McCullough, the president of the Eastmoreland Neighborhood Association and Southeast Uplift.
I'll buy the coffee. This is the friendliest possible meeting that I want to have. Telephone call will be fine. I want to see if we can get the players in one place and see if we can not have cookie-cutter homes and lose our trees, but have architect-designed homes that will take advantage of the landscape and will be vastly more valuable, and everyone can win.
Great. I've been speaking with Robert McCullough. As I mentioned, he's the president of the Eastmoreland Neighborhood Association and Southeast Uplift regarding the planned removal of 3 more than 100-year-old sequoias. Those are scheduled to be potentially removed along with the demolition of a house on Southeast Martins. And we are awaiting response after contacting both Commissioner Fritz and people in the city bureaucracy regarding urban forestry.
Thank you very, very much.
Going to have to leave it. What's that? Okay, what's going on? It was me.
You are listening to the Cable Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jimmy Tardy, Elizabeth Gleason, and Catherine Maticek. Our producer is Galen Sanford. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at kbonews. If you would like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard about on the news tonight, here are their phone numbers, so grab something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Tarina Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now!, news magazine hosted by award-winning journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Voices from the Edge, progressive talk radio from a grassroots perspective, hosted by Joanne Hardesty. At 9, hear Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know, with Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, host Perfugering will talk with James Bradley, author of The China Mirage. Bradley's father was one of the fighting men who raised the American flag on Iwo Jima in a war that was born in delusion and duplicity. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, local news with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, David Naiman talks with Mary Ruffel, critically acclaimed poet and essayist, about her approach to art, the questions she comes back to, and the artists that influence her. Mary Ruffel is the author of 14 books, including 12 volumes of poetry, a book of prose, and a collection of lectures. At 11:30, it's Black Book Talk, featuring interviews and discussions of works by African-American authors, hosted by Patricia Welch. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not yet a KBOO member, you can become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.